You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Alexander Ross. Alexander, thanks so much for being with me today.
Hey, hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Alexander, we're going to talk about your show at Miles McHenry Gallery, of course, and which is running through the 3rd of February of this new year, 2024. To begin with, you know, I it's a fascinating show on so many levels. You know, oftentimes I talk about like the language in here, what's happening, and your work, of course, addresses this in a complex way. And it seems in one way you're trying to confuse the understanding of this, right? And whether and what it is exactly that we're looking at. As I know, even the catalog essay was saying, you know, it's kind of the thought of one viewer, historian, you know, is this figurative? Is this abstract? You know, and it also looks quite sculptural in this exhibit. So so to begin with, yeah, this body of work, how do you feel that this differs in that context from other bodies of work of yours?
I think it's been pretty consistent most of the time that I'm embracing this ambiguity and allowing lots of different readings to be in there. It makes it more interesting, I think, or is my hope. And I mean, occasionally I'll nail something down and it'll seem a little more specific. Like for a little short while, I was getting slightly figurative, but most of the time I'm hovering around ambiguities between scale. Like, is it huge? Is it microscopic? Where is it? You know, the location is indeterminate, and the meanings, especially, I like them to be unknowable, or you know, multiple readings on them. Is it alive? Is it synthetic? I love those two sort of tangling together. Yeah, all that stuff.
I like that too. So to go through some of them, because the titles also, you know, are telling in their own way. There's Modeling the Physical in this show, which is about 22 by 18. And this is, you know, a work that is reflective of some of the others, pencil, graphite, and crayon. But the title seems to be almost, you know, reading what it is, right? This feels enormously sculptural. It feels very, very physical, and it feels like the almost like the in-between of a modeling process. It has a sensuality to it. The clay feels like, or it looks like clay to me, feels like, you know, it's supple. It can be modeled. So it strikes me as something that's about process itself, like this could be changed or something like that. But I guess I'm reflecting on the title itself, Modeling the Physical.
Well, it is definitely all those things. And then I'm also thinking in a kind of maybe more of a metaphysical way of like, these are so specifically physical, like the way the lumps and folds are catching the light for me has always been sort of like, let's demonstrate physicality in its sort of utmost raw way, where it's there and it's unquestionably material. And then for me, that's sort of a springboard into this idea that the world is some kind of an illusion, or it's a kind of a simulated truth that we take as reality. So it's a kind of a deeper philosophical investigation in my mind, and all the titles refer to this sort of meta thinking that I have on top of it all. And that's always been there with the work, but for the first time recently, I decided to start titling things to allow this part of my thinking into the process. But it is also, like you said, is straightforward. I mean, these are actual clay models that I'm making with the intent of having them feel, you know, their utmost reality. Like there was a term people used to use with the arts called the plasticity, the plastic nature of what you're depicting. And I always like to take that more literally. I mean, I know they meant, you know, the materiality of the subject, but I was in my mind thinking, yeah, plastic, like this is Sculpey, which is a plastic version of plasticine. So it's actually literally like molded plastic.
Right. That's a different version of, yeah, what's often referred to as plasticity. Yeah. taking it in another direction. I like that. I mean, yeah, the Sculpey, this kind of material too, when I look at it, it seems that, you know, there has to be a conscious choice not for this to be too figurative. I mean, it's so easy for eyes and nose to just kind of pop out of this. And that way of working, which I don't really remember working with clay like this since I was a little kid, but it just seems to kind of lend itself almost to doing something figurative, right, or narrative. So what I'm asking, and I'm thinking especially about the image intelligence restructuring, that the non-narrative quality, the non-figurative quality, is part of the plasticity and what you're talking about here, right? It's almost intentionally not that, even though I'm still pulling sort of figurative things out of even this one.
Yeah, it's very hard not to accidentally have little faces and possible readings of eyes and nostrils. And I decided at a certain point, you know what, I don't care anymore. I'm not looking for them, and I'm not intentionally making them most of the time. So if they do appear after the fact, I'm okay with it. I just, again, it's like people see things, and I let them see them. But you're right, I'm trying really hard to keep it ambiguous and to keep it, you know, mysterious. I mean, but, you know, so for a long time they were hovering around the color green, which is my intention of suggesting chlorophyll and things, you know, plant-like things or corals or things that are somehow alive. These new ones are much more colorful than I've ever done before. So it starts to change again. It's like these are like little, almost like living fine art bodies of some kind. And all this originated with the Petri dish, with things that are like little colonies that are emerging and growing and fusing together. And they're alive, yet they look like little splotches of paint or little blobs of clay, possibly.
Right. That's intelligence restructuring, possibly, right? Is what that's hinting at a little bit in the title?
The intelligence restructuring comes from my thinking about nature herself and how she is permeating everything. My belief is that everything is nature, and that we have this artificial category where we see ourselves as somehow we are special, but just because we're doing something new doesn't mean we're not still part of the natural evolution. So even the works that we create, like bulldozers and skyscrapers, I see as extensions similar to other things that other animals make, like bird nests. They're just much more elaborate, but they're still coming from nature. So the intelligence restructuring is a big leap, I think, for most people, but I even see things like computers, the internet, and especially AI as an extension of what nature, Mother Nature, has always been doing. She's been exploring and probing what's possible in the world, and AI is part of that. So I'm looking at it like, well, down the road, you know, maybe it's a new form of intelligence. It's certainly not human intelligence or physical intelligence, but a machinic intelligence that emerges in nature. So I was labeling that like maybe a new level of evolutionary achievement, or I don't know, I hate to think hierarchically, but I see them as like rungs on a ladder. And, you know, humanity and human language was a big step out beyond just being alive. And then this AI possibly could be seen as a new kind of intelligence restructuring.
Yeah, that's so interesting, because it seems that that's what we're in the middle of, between AI and all the things that it's spawning and that we're rethinking, that there is some kind of restructuring going on, which puts art again in a curious place, right? To think of the role of AI and all this restructuring that mm-hmm. we don't quite understand yet what's going on. The internet as a brain in itself, a neural network. You know, it's right. Such a different world entirely from looking at your art, right? I mean, that's a subject, but looking at your art is one thing that. And I know this is related, but not quite exactly what you're talking about, but art is one of those things that or it would seem that the work that you're making right now is kind of impossible for AI to create. You know, it's goals, it's impressions, it's sensuality. And I don't know, I'm not saying that as a pushback against AI, but though it's talking about all these issues, it seems also to be the exception to that rule. Or maybe that's just what I'd like to think. Well, what do you think?
Yeah, I think we all would like to think that. I mean, I'm not afraid of AI and worried about it all that much, as much as a lot of people seem to be. I do think it puts people out of work, possibly, and all that, and it's sort of plagiarizing, which is totally uncomfortable. But I guess I'm seeing it as far as my work, and I mean, I'm not even really thinking about it. I'm just assuming that there's some inherent qualities that are so incredibly rich in our hardware, like my eyes and the lens in my eyes and my head are so incredibly sophisticated, and it's no match so far for machines. So I'm just assuming that there's going to always be this inherent and human quality that comes through good art, and it's going to always be there. The machine art will be its own thing. It'll be amazing and spectacular. It already is. And intriguing and fun, and but I guess I don't feel like we need to react to it so much as just it parallels, like music is paralleling along with synthesizers. It's not like synthesizers have replaced all the instruments, although in some cases the tool is useful for musicians, but we still have the grand pianos and we still have opera. I guess I'm seeing it as like, you know, continuing on doing our human thing. I don't think they'll ever fully be competitive because humans are different than machines.
Right. Yeah. It's such an interesting and new part of evolution, I suppose, as you're saying. There's another painting that maybe can feed into this conversation, which is different than what we've just been talking about a little bit, another aspect of the presentation. This one, you know, in such an interesting way feels like we're further back, the scale feels completely different, and the approach, and of course, yeah, so to speak to that title, but also the way this is constructed and put together looks quite different than the rest. Palette,
yeah,
similar, as you were saying, but another aspect of presentation.
Right. This one's definitely pulled back a little. It's more topographical. You feel like you're flying over something. There's a lot more like fracturing I was doing with the clay and remerging. So it's got a bit more feeling of like landscape in the way like land masses shift and fold and crumble together. So I love all those little like fractures and disjunctures that touch and go. To me, it's just an effort of trying to make it interesting visually, first of all, trying to give a lot of possibilities for the light and shadows to fall and collapse throughout the image and make it activated. And then this idea of another aspect of the presentation is getting back to that idea of nature is exploring and finding all kinds of different ways to manifest in all, throughout evolution. And so you could almost think of like any presentation or view or way of that nature unfolds is another aspect of what nature can do. So I'm thinking, okay, well, we're all nature, I'm nature, and what the art I make is an extension of what nature is doing. I mean, I'm just channeling stuff. It's hard to lay claim to even the creativity and the originality of what I'm doing. I feel it just comes out of me unprovoked, and I don't even know if I'm in control of it. So here's another aspect of what nature does. It's another aspect of her presentation.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It leads into so many other subjects, it seems. So to talk about this palette a little bit too, which is, you know, consistent in all the work, that's also a kind of new range for you, right? The palette seems to me, and it's just my own association with with childhood or the materials that you're using. You know, I can't get a little video out of my head now, which is just of my, I think, 4 or 5 year old son at a diner, and I'm taking a video of him with a big piece of clay in his hand, just sticking his thumb in it and poking holes and looking at it from different directions. And, and you know, it has that kind of that color, that there's a playful quality in here, but also that sense of just looking, you know, just as this 5 year old was looking at different sides thinking, what is this? What is this? And it never got figurative even for him there. That's also what's happening in some of these, isn't it? There's a looking. The viewer keeps looking at this, like, what am I seeing and what is that? And even if we're not pulling figurative things out of it, we're doing something like that, right?
Yeah, I love that. I love that. I mean, everything you just said is exactly, you know, my unconsciously bringing that into the work. But is there something, you know, like little Gumby animations and just childhood wonder and... And also, yes, looking carefully. I mean, part of the fun of being the artist making these things is I get to care about these little surfaces, and I get to pore over them and sort of caress and touch every little part of the surface. It's like a deep exploration of something inherently, it has no meaning. It has no, you know, it's just a made-up nonsense landscape of some kind. But by taking it so seriously and working it very carefully, I'm suddenly bringing it into some kind of reality of its own. And that's the thing that art does that I love, is that it transforms things into something else. So whatever this was, it's now a drawing with watercolor underneath, and it's become its own entity. I mean, art, I think, should always do something that only art can do. Otherwise, it's photography or AI or something else.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And there's one more in here. I mean, it's great going through these images because the titles themselves seem to launch into different areas. Robed in the Illusion is another one that's in this show. And that is, you know, also watercolor, pencil and paper. This one also seems to point to something else, right? They're all, in a sense, to me, robed in illusion in a way, like what's going on here? But this one has a certain kind of negative space in it, something else that's happening here, the large kind of pink object in front, which viewers can hopefully see images of all of these in the interview, but that has impressions in it. It almost looks like something was there, or I guess this is the association I'm bringing to that title, "Robed in the Illusion."
It's cool. I love hearing the effects of the titles. You know, because everyone, of course, is going to find their own meaning even in the titles. And in fact, I look at titling almost like a way of extending the creative process into language itself. But "Robed in the Illusion," you're right. I mean, I was talking about that before, how we live in a material world, yet we know that quarks, which make up the atoms of our world, are really like information packets, but they don't have their own material reality. They're implied that they're potentially material, that they have potential mass, but only when they work together in aggregate do our brains perceive actual material and actual mass. So it's an emergent property of quarks that they become material, and it's like a collaboration with our minds that they become our material world that we live in. So in that sense, if you accept that and aren't really resisting it, but just accepting it, that this world is a kind of illusion in that sense, and you embrace it. So my idea of being robed in the illusion is an acceptance of and an embracing of the material world, even though we know it's, in a sense, a kind of abstract information-generated illusion that we're in. The acceptance of it is, in a sense, like wearing it proudly rather than resisting it, saying, oh, there's all these problems. No, the illusion is perfect the way it is, and in fact, I'm going to be robed in the illusion confidently. So I don't know if that fully works for you, but that's where I got
that
idea.
I love that.
It's almost
that
like
work for me.
Yeah, like you come down from a kind of an enlightened state, and instead of feeling a resistance to the deception, so-called deception of the illusion, you instead embrace it not as a deception, but as the very purpose and point of being here. So it's a kind of a post-enlightenment bodhisattva way of treating our illusion.
I love that. That is clear. That makes a lot of sense. And it reminds me of it's a slightly different take, maybe more evolved on. I don't know if you saw the movie Get Back, the remaking of the Let It Be movie by the Beatles. It was them, basically yes. Their last session breaking up. But there was one interesting moment in that sprawling documentary where they're talking about the Maharishi in India, John and George are kind of making fun of each other, looking like a college professor, and maybe we should have paid more attention. And George says, if you were paying attention, if we were really doing it, we wouldn't even be making this music right now. We wouldn't be doing this. And of course, John and Paul just look at him like, okay, anyway, you know, but it was sort of fascinating, right? And that's a bit what you're talking about here, right? That notion of coming down from enlightenment, you wouldn't make art anymore, is kind of what George was saying. And what you were saying,
Yeah, go ahead. I'm saying the opposite.
No, right. You're saying the opposite, that even understanding that it's all an illusion, what they must have learned with the Maharishi in India, that we're making this music that is robed in illusion. It's still what we do. It's okay to do it. We don't have to do nothing.
Yeah, exactly. The whole point of being here is making the music and letting nature play the music through you. That's the crowning jewel of why the whole thing is here in the first place. So I think there's a tendency to first recognize, oh, this is an illusion, and that we somehow need to escape it or be free of it. And there's a whole tradition of painting the illusion as the bad guy, you know, the Maya that's deceiving us. It's like a trick of some kind or a test that we have to escape from. And then finally you realize, okay, I accept it. It is an illusion, and now I'm free from it, and I can be the oneness and the source, which is great, but then they stop. Like, I feel like George stopped there, and instead you need to then come back into the illusion with the understanding of, like, oh, I see, the whole point of being one and creating the illusion in the first place for myself was the illusion. It's like, as soon as you're one, you realize you need an illusion, and then when you're the illusion, you realize you need to understand yourself as one. So that's the snake eating its tail. But you don't just stay in one or the other. Once you realize that there's only this oneness, you realize, oh, the illusion has a point or a purpose. Otherwise, why would I bother making it?
Right.
Making
yeah.
sense to you?
It did make sense. It made a lot of sense, and I think it'll make sense to the listeners too. Thanks so much for talking to me about this and putting together this beautiful show. I want to ask you one more off-topic question before we go, which is, what are you reading at the moment?
Well, I am slowly working my way through Dahlgren by Samuel Delaney, written in 1975. It's a really interesting, strange book. It's considered a masterpiece, but people don't know how to classify it because he's a sci-fi writer, but it's barely science fiction. It's more like a post-apocalypse. I think it's one of the first post-apocalyptic books. And stuff like Mad Max and all these things maybe got their start from this 1975 book. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's considered one of the great and notable literature. But it's transgressive as hell. I mean, there's, you know, sex happening throughout, and every kind of sex you can imagine. There's all kinds of racial stuff. I mean, Samuel Delaney is black. So his use of racism in the book is very challenging, even especially these days. So it's a curious book, and it's also just beautifully written and fascinating. It's got a lot of class stuff, tough guys and hoodlums intermingling with rich people and aesthetes. A really fascinating, strange book.
Thanks so much. I'm so glad you mentioned that. Alexander, I want to thank so much for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure, and I wish you well with the show, and I hope the listeners can see it in time before the end of February in 2024.
Yeah, thank you, Brandon. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.